Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ongoing tragedy in Nepal and speak with Alexander von Rosbart, a professor of Buddhist and South Asian studies at the University of California, Berkeley, who has over 20 years of field experience in the Kathmandu Valley, which was devastated by Saturday's earthquake that has claimed more than 4,000 lives. We will discuss rescue efforts underway and international help that already has the airport at Kathmandu unable to park any more planes. Then we'll look into the U.S. visit of Japan's Prime Minister Abe, who will address a joint session of Congress on Wednesday. Thomas Berger, Professor of International Relations at Boston University and author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, joins us to discuss Abe's efforts to crack down on press freedom and his continual denial of World War II atrocities, as well as the reversal underway in Japan's post-war pacifist defense posture as the U.S. encourages Japan to join it in containing China both militarily and economically with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. Then finally, we will speak with Huri Barberin, who is a professor of history at the and director of the Middle East program at California State University, Long Beach. She's just back from Turkey, where she participated in demonstrations on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, which, in spite of Turkey's growing international isolation, President Erdogan insists did not happen. And joining us now is Alexander von Rosbart, who is a professor of Buddhist and South Asian Studies and director of the Group of Buddhist Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. With over 20 years of field work in Nepal studying local Buddhist communities in the Kathmandu Valley, his latest book is The Vayambu Chaitya and Its Renovation, which deals with the periodic renovations of the Vayambu Stupa of Kathmandu. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander von Rosbart.
Welcome, Ian. Thank you for having me on the program.
And clearly, Alexander, the human toll and the humanitarian catastrophe dwarfs all other considerations at this point. But my understanding is, in terms of the work that you've been doing, much of the cultural heritage and the religious heritage of Buddhism in Nepal, many of these stupas and temples have been destroyed. Is that your understanding?
Yes, particularly temples, pagoda-style temples with several tiers have been destroyed. Kashta Mandap, the main temple, historically speaking, at the Royal Square in Kathmandu, has been destroyed. The five-story temple at Bhaktapur has been destroyed. And many other of these, very, very valuable and precious temples. And that is just the beginning. These are the most visible temples. And I fear that many other similar historical structures will have been downed. And after, the necessary humanitarian relief efforts have gone under the way, it will be very important, I believe, to also pay attention to this and to rebuild and rescue as much of this, invaluable cultural heritage, not just for Nepal, but really for mankind at large. Many of these are UNESCO heritage sites, to rebuild these sites.
And Alexander von Rosbart, you are married to Nepalese and presumably, you're all in touch with relatives in Nepal. What are they telling you? Because my understanding is that the death toll obviously will grow much higher than the 4,200 at this point that the Associated Press is reporting. A lot of the rural communities are devastated. The roads are buckled. Landslides have closed many of them. So it's very difficult to get to the countryside to get a full sense of the scope of the tragedy. But what are your relatives telling you?
Yeah, the friends and relatives I have in the Kathmandu Valley I spoke with, they're all actually fine, which, is a great relief to hear from me. And they're also, by and large, say that their houses have survived the quakes well. And, it's almost like an eerie sense of normality that comes through their conversations. But the great concern is, at the background, what is going to happen when the water supplies that people have typically in a house, what's going to happen once they're depleted? One friend I spoke with, they have a small well on the compound, but they don't have electricity to pump the water out. Other places run out of water, they go to their neighbors' places. So water is a critical concern. It's actually a concern at all times in the Kathmandu Valley, but it's become a really crucial concern now. There's also, I think, the danger that sewage might contaminate ordinary drinking water as they come in contact with each other. And even at the best of times, Nepal is not doing a good job to provide water to its citizens. So without foreign aid pouring in, this, you know, has all of, you know, the writing is on the wall that this could turn to, in a sense, even greater tragedy than the earthquake itself. So it's not, you know, my particular expertise, but I think it's obvious that what is really needed is water and water treatment plants and taking care of these things. But to repeat what I said at the beginning, the sense that I get is that most people inside the Kathmandu Valley were spared. Much to the surprise of experts, the often rather flimsily built concrete houses erected over the last 50 years or so have withstood the quake very well, while the traditionally built houses were actually the ones that suffered most. So the valley has, as terrible as a catastrophe is, many people, including myself, thought that it would be even worse. But we all don't know what's going on in the mountainous areas. My understanding is that the roads are just starting to be cleared and rescue teams will finally have access to these mountainous regions. But these houses, by and large, are traditionally built, and the fear is that many more people will have perished who have yet not been accounted for.
But in terms of international aid, already the airport at Kathmandu literally has no space left to park aircraft.
That indeed is very good, and India, as you know, has been there very quickly. Other South Asian countries, Sri Lanka, Pakistan have poured in, China, I heard Turkey has come in, Japan, Germany. So I think there's a lot of aid, and you're absolutely right that the airport, which however is very small, is already running out of space. And of course, the Nepalese army itself is also, you know, on the ground and doing whatever they can. But of course, with collapsed houses and people being pulled out of the rubble, time is running out quickly. I spoke with a friend, a Nepalese friend here, and the house of her cousin collapsed, and they were able to rescue part of the family, but not the cousin himself. When they pulled him out, he'd already died. So obviously, it's also a fight against time.
And the buildings that collapsed, are they sort of mud brick? Is that what the construction is?
Well, they're basically brick, but they don't have, you know, the concrete framing that modern houses have. Mm-hmm. If they've been very solidly built with strong beams and so on, they will have withstood the earthquake. But, you know, typically, of course, it's the underprivileged and poorer people who live in such buildings. And the houses are not built, you know, with the necessary, you know, material to build them in such a way that they withstand such a quake. So indeed, it's houses built of bricks and mud and with very little wood that basically caved in and collapsed.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander von Rusbart, who is a professor of Buddhist and South Asian Studies and director of the Group in Buddhist Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He has over 20 years of field work in Nepal studying local Buddhist communities in the Kathmandu Valley that was devastated by Saturday's earthquake. So the country itself is, I think, 145th on the UN index of the poorest countries, I think, the poorest is ranked at about 180 something. So it's way, you know, down there on the list of the poorest countries. It was also devastated politically by a massacre of much of the royal family, I understand, by a disgruntled relative. And it doesn't sound, it seems like ever since then it's been in some sort of political paralysis. And then on top of that, you have the remittances that come from abroad, from the Gurkhas with the British Army that's downsizing, So it's basically down to tourism in terms of income, and that's going to be impacted as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest political challenge has been the Maoist insurgency that, with the country on the brink of an outright civil war. But fortunately, that danger has been diffused, and there is a political process in place, albeit a rather torturous political process that is, moving at a glacial speed. But at least there is peace in the country, and the hope that one should have at this moment is that political parties put their differences behind. And also, when I think of infrastructure, the infrastructure is woefully underdeveloped, particularly the provision of water and electricity. The Kathmandu, the town of Kathmandu was for several years the fastest growing urban space, above 100,000 people in Asia, faster growing than any other city, and infrastructure is not at all kept up with it. It really needs to be rebuilt now, and if there's a silver lining on the horizon, it could be that this is an opportunity where donor nations help the Nepalese in actually doing the things they should have done long ago.
And in terms of the Maoist insurgency that was quite brutal in the countryside, it was a homegrown insurgency, wasn't it? Have the Chinese essentially cut bait with them? It was never clear that the Chinese, and of course, you know, you have a new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, is bringing back Mao. But I didn't think the Chinese were actually backing the Maoists, were they?
You're absolutely right. The Chinese were not interested in being associated with this. Indeed, they distanced themselves very explicitly from this uprising, but the homegrown communists behind the uprising, they found inspiration in Mao, and they actually considered contemporary China to basically have been betraying Maoist ideas. So they were certainly not in sync with the Chinese, with modern-day contemporary China.
And in terms of the work that you've been doing with over 20 years of fieldwork in the Kathmandu Valley, which is, I don't know whether it was the epicenter, but it certainly was severely damaged. It has its own sort of indigenous form of Buddhism, is that right?
Yeah, so Buddhism disappeared in India basically 800 years ago. And the one place where it survived on the Indian subcontinent is in the Kathmandu Valley. So it's a very archaic tradition, a sole survivor of Indian Mahayana Buddhism. And it's a very small community that is already under siege because of the forces of modernity that are so very different than the sensitivities of this particular tradition. So I am concerned that the monasteries and temples that are the backbone, so to speak, the physical architectural backbone of this tradition, that their devastation may also weaken the tradition that is already weak to start with further. That indeed is a real concern for somebody like myself who studies and also sympathizes with that tradition.
But of course, we're seeing a lot of pictures of Hindu cremations out in the open, with obviously lots and lots of bodies still being recovered. So what's the percentage of Hindu versus Buddhist in the population?
Well, the Buddhist tradition I'm talking about, they're confined to the Kathmandu Valley. So mm-hmm. The autochthonous original indigenous population living there. And they roughly split half and half between Hindus and Buddhists. Nowadays, over the last 10 to 20 years, they've actually been become a minority because of the huge influx of people of the countryside. So nowadays, these traditional old-style Buddhists are actually in a minority. But as far as cremations and funerary rituals is concerned, they follow the same tradition of cremating bodies, so Buddhists and Hindus in that situation will be treated in the same way.
And what's your feeling when you talk to your relatives about foreign aid and foreign attention? So much of our attention in the media has been on a few sort of wealthy climbers lost on Mount Everest.
Yeah, I personally am, of course, unhappy about this, as much as I understand that it's easier to identify with our own folks than with other people. I do think that the attention paid to a few climbers compared to thousands of people perishing in the Kathmandu Valley is really a poor way of reporting. I'm not sure that my family and friends in Nepal have perceived this in the same way, simply because they don't follow the Western media as much. And of course, in the Nepalese media, the tragedies at Mount Everest have not received the same coverage they have in our media.
And in terms of tourism, there are lots of sort of, I guess, vestiges of the hippie days, aren't they? There's thousands of foreigners, so many of whom haven't been. I think there's like 700 Australians that they haven't accounted for, even more French nationals. What are those people doing?
Yeah, my this is not a real high period for tourism, because it's
right.
The real time to visit the Kathmandu Valley is in fall, in October and November. So the people who are in Nepal at this time, they're typically there for trekking, for going into the mountain.
Oh, I see. So they're more like yuppies, not hippies.
No, they're more backpackers and hikers.
Right.
And, the hippie days are over also in Kathmandu,
right,
even though there are lingering traces.
Right.
And
I'm dating myself.
It's my understanding that there, it's my expectation, not my understanding. It's my expectation that there are not huge numbers in the Kathmandu Valley. I've been in contact with a student of mine who's doing research in the Kathmandu Valley. She, with other Westerners, is camped on the grounds of the Hyatt Hotel at the outskirts of Kathmandu, because it's still not safe enough to sleep inside the houses. Even though the houses still stand, they continue to shake. I just spoke with a friend this afternoon, and he said that yesterday evening before they went to bed, basically, our morning here on the West Coast, there was another earthquake, and the house was shaking again. So people don't dare going back into the houses. And the foreigners, as much as the Nepalese, most of them are actually camping outside. And as I said, I think many of the foreigners have found a refuge in the grounds, the sprawling grounds of the Hyatt Hotel.
And they have apparently cell phone service in Nepal, but they can call out to the U.S., but it's difficult to call from the U.S. to Nepal. We've been found that out as well.
Yeah, actually, my latest attempts of contacting people worked. The landline worked much better. I think people are slowly returning to their houses and discovering that their landlines are still working. Of course, we couldn't reach them before because they simply weren't at home. So I did initially actually contact people via cell phones, but the cell phone communication has actually gone down. It's not as good as it was initially, partly because there is an acute lack of electricity, which is the other big chronic problem that Nepal has, a lack of water and the lack of electricity. That too needs to be addressed, and most of the little electricity that the country has comes from hydroelectric power plants, and it's my fear, and also I heard this on the news, that some of these power plants have actually been damaged, which speaks to further cuts in electricity.
Well, just in closing, Alexander, it does seem that the world is responding, at least immediately, to a lot of the needs. Obviously, some of the needs that you've talked about in terms of water, hydroelectricity, electricity generating in general, are long-term unmet needs. So massive investments have to be made, apart from the Band-Aids that are pouring in now. But then you've got this longer-term issue, which is the cultural heritage that's been destroyed. Who's going to step up to the plate, assuming that people do on the former, on the latter?
Well, it happens that there's a wonderful outfit working out of Kathmandu, out of New York, called the Kathmandu Valley Preservation Trust. And they have, over the last decades, done absolutely critical work in restoring temples. And I've been in touch with the people running the organization. They've set up a website in order to receive donations. And I expect them over the next decades, indeed, to be involved in rescuing what can be rescued. They have the expertise. In particular, they have local experts on the ground, Nepalese. So unlike many other agencies, foreign agencies, they have practically no administrative overhead. They pay local salaries. So whatever money they receive goes way longer than money ordinarily given to NGOs working in Nepal. And it's my hope that such organizations, there are others out, but the Kathmandu Valley Preservation Trust has a particularly good record, that such organizations will step up to the plate. And once the immediate humanitarian crisis has been addressed, that this will not be forgotten. That, I think, is the great danger. Now the images that we get are terrible. Everybody is shocked and roused to help. But it's not just about temples. It's also about it's not just about the cultural heritage. It's also about the social fabric that is basically woven into these architectural structures. In other words, if a temple is destroyed, it can also be a whole community that disintegrates. So it's very important to not forget that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Alexander von Raspat.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander von Raspat, who's a professor of Buddhist and South Asian Studies and director of the Group of Buddhist Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He has over 20 years of field work in Nepal, studying local Buddhist communities in the Kathmandu Valley. And his latest book, The Viambu Chaitya and Its Renovation, deals with the periodic renovations of the Viambu Stupa of Kathmandu. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the new U.S. and Japanese defense partnership. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Yes, good evening. Thank you very much for having me.
And Thomas, the Prime Minister of Japan is in the United States. He's got a number of visits this week, the White House on Tuesday, and an address to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday. But already we're learning about a new Japan-U.S. defense posture that's being developed. And it's actually a major reversal from Japan's traditional pacifist constitution following World War II. And it could actually involve deeper cooperation with the U.S. and Japan. For example, Japan could end up shooting down missiles heading to the United States from either China or North Korea, even though that's not necessarily on the agenda. Or on the horizon even, but still. And my question to you, just to get to start with the defense side of it, how do you navigate that idea that you've got a more robust defense cooperation and a deeper defense alliance between Japan and the United States, but at the same time, how does the United States avoid getting dragged into a shooting war with China over a contested pile of rocks in the South China Sea?
Well, there's an awful lot to respond to, but first of all, I would point out that what's taking place right now between the U.S. and Japan is really an extension of processes that have been taking years. I mean, we are, thanks to the leadership of Prime Minister Abe, we are seeing now various initiatives being pushed through and implemented that we've wanted for a very long time. The U.S.-Japanese alliance was always a bit of a one-sided affair. Basically, the U.S. committed itself to providing defense for Japan in the case that Japan was attacked, but Japan had relatively limited obligations to help the United States. Even in the defense of Japan, there were certain limitations placed upon how far the two sides could cooperate with one another. And what we're having right now is really moving towards a more balanced strategic alliance between the two sides. And it's something that I think that here in the United States we very much welcome. Now, of course, the problem that you point out is that there are tensions between Japan and its neighbors, and in particular between Japan and the People's Republic of China. And a major focus of that has been these disputed islands in the East China Seas, the Senkaku. The Japanese call them Senkaku, and the Chinese call them Diaoyu Islands. These are relatively small, uninhabited islands. They have some economic value. They have some strategic value. But they are basically of great importance in the context of Chinese and Japanese domestic politics. They have become the focus of fierce nationalist passions on both sides. The Japanese control those islands, but the Chinese are, in a very real but also very controlled and low-profile way, testing Japan's control over those islands. And tensions have been rising a great deal, especially since 2012. And now, for the first time, we do have a concern that we could be dragged into a war by some kind of incident developing over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. At this point in time, however, I would say that that threat is easily exaggerated. The balance of power that is given the sort of overwhelming preponderance of air and sea and strategic nuclear forces, which are on the side of the United States and its allies in this region, really deters the Chinese or anyone else, for that matter, from trying to sort of challenge this more vigorously. However, there is the possibility, there's a sort of game of brinksmanship, a kind of game of chicken, if you like, that is going on over those islands, and the possibility of some unplanned incident emerging and then escalating to a level that no one is interested in having it escalate to is very real. And that is an issue that the two sides, all sides, that is the United States, Japan, but also China, are sort of gingerly trying to navigate.
But clearly, this new defense posture is aimed at containing China, and equally true, is it not, that the world's largest economy, the United States, and the world's third largest economy, Japan, are also working on this Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact?
And I would be very careful to use the term contain because we have not moved into a containment strategy vis-a-vis China of the sort that we moved towards vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, or for that matter, the kind of policy that we have towards North Korea. It's a totally different kettle of fish. While there are certain points where we have tensions with China, there are also an awful lot of areas where we want to work with the Chinese, and the Chinese want to work with us, be it trade, investment, environmental protection, all of these areas. And what we're doing is a very difficult diplomatic game of trying to engage China on multiple levels. And this is true of Japan as well. The Japanese also have enormous interests in maintaining good economic interests and other interests, maintaining good relations with China. But at the same time, we cannot ignore that there is an assertive side to Chinese foreign policy, and that moreover the Chinese are building up their military forces at a very rapid clip, and that this poses problems for us. So we're hedging against the possibility of Chinese assertion even while we're trying to engage the Chinese. Now, on the economic side, and I don't pretend to be an expert on this, but on the economic side, we are negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a very ambitious, sweeping trade agreement, which includes the United States and Japan, but also several other countries in the Pacific Rim, including, Brunei and Singapore and others. And that But that policy right now, that those negotiations do not include China. But I do think one of the things that might happen down the line is that we might want to include China once we have in place the kinds of protections on consumer and environmental issues and a number of other issues relating to intellectual property rights and so forth have settled. So it's not aimed necessarily against China, but the Chinese do see it often that way. I mean, there is a perception in China that all of this is aimed at containing them. But I think really the real long-term strategy on this part of the United States, to quote Robert Zoellick, formerly Deputy Assistant to Secretary of State, is to turn China into a responsible stakeholder, that is, into a member of the international community which plays by the rules as we know them.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Well, of course, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is in effect being held up because of just of a central dispute between the United States and Japan over protection on this in U.S. side of its automobile industry and on the Japanese side of its agricultural industries.
No. I mean, there's strong, deeply vested interests which are on both sides, which are digging in their heels over this. There's a great deal of skepticism, I would say, especially in the U.S. side, about promotion of this kind of sweeping free trade agreement. But I think at the same time, both the Obama administration and the Abe government in Japan is very much committed to pushing this forward. From the Japanese perspective, it plays at least two important roles. One is it is giving an important impetus, a push to a structural reform. That is, the Japanese are trying to leverage external pressure from the TPP and from the United States to push through contentious domestic political and economic reforms, including in the agricultural sector. And Abe has done that. The other thing, of course, is that, and this is something that both the United States and Japan are very much concerned about, is that we want our strategy towards East Asia. I mean, the Obama administration has put a new emphasis on the Pacific region, the Pacific Asia region, the so-called pivot to Asia. And we want to make that not only a military exercise, but to give it economic and political substance of a different sort as well. So I think the Japanese very much welcome that. The United States wants to pursue it.
So in terms of what is going on domestically in Japan, the New York Times is carrying a story on Monday, efforts by Japan to stifle news media is working. And it tells a story of a very popular TV commentator and anchor who made a public display of how the government is squeezing him, and they eventually got. I mean, in other words, he was fired. It was a bit like that movie with Peter Finch. I'm fed up, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you know, that whole thing of a guy having a meltdown on live television, and he held up a sign saying "I'm not Abe," which was a play on the French Charlie Hebdo magazine. And there is a sense that, we know from Fukushima that there was an awful a lack of information that came out between the government and the press. I mean, the government's been sort of really pretty hard-nosed. And the article indicates that this is not an overt form of censorship, but a more subtle, persuasive form of censorship where the Abe's government have just sort of talked to the bosses in the media, and they've decided they don't want to have any problems, and they've virtually hung out their reporters to dry.
Well, I mean, I would go a little bit further than that. I mean, every government, of course, tries to spin the press, tries to make sure that it gets its message out. Every government has political leader cultivates contacts with some media outlets and discriminates against others. But I'm afraid that the Abe administration has been going a bit beyond spin doctoring on this one. And there has been some more ugly forms of criticism and pressure being exerted on the media in Japan. Now, this is not, but I mean, Japan, I want to underline, is a democracy. We have freedom of press. There, these institutions are strong, and I think they are generally supported in the by the Japanese public. But what is happening is that on certain issues, certain ideologically sensitive issues, especially pertaining to history and to territorial issues, that the Abe administration has sort of drawn a line and is more vigorously attacking some of those press media outlets that it sees as being critical of it. Now, that form of control is most overt, obviously, in public media. Japan has the NHK, Japan Broadcasting, National Broadcasting Corporation. That has a governor, which is appointed by the prime minister. And Abe has appointed a very conservative leadership to the NHK, and they have clamped down on certain kinds of reporting, especially pertaining to history. The Asahi newspaper, which is sort of the, if you'd like, in some ways, New York Times of Japan, though there are a number of other leading newspapers as well, but the Asahi newspaper is the sort of standard bearer of the left, and it has come in for very fierce, vigorous criticism, including from members of the Abe cabinet, for mistakes it made in its reporting regarding the comfort women, the 200,000 or so, it is estimated, women who were conscripted or into a sexual service, sexual slavery, many would call it. In many cases, it was sexual slavery by the Japanese army during the Second World War. This has become a particularly ugly and unpleasant chapter. And Asahi newspaper has been fiercely criticized, been forced to engage in self-criticism over this issue. And that has had a chilling effect on many reporters and many, journalists in Japan.
But Thomas, did they make a mistake, or is this a part of the Abe's government's efforts to do two things? One, to change the Japanese attitude towards its pacifist post-World War II constitution, which is part of our earlier conversation with what's going on now in Washington, mm-hmm. and two, the continuing denial about World War II atrocities.
Well, I think it's both. I mean, Asahi newspaper, and I know people in Asahi newspaper, and I've spoken to them about this. I mean, there was a mistake made. They had an unreliable source, and they used that for reporting on it, and they made an error. Now, they would, however, stick by the main thrust of their story. That is, there was this atrocious chapter, this terrible history of the forced a conscription of tens of thousands of women as basically sexual slaves by the Japanese military or for the Japanese military during the Second World War. And they would not go back on it. But the Abe administration wants to go further on this issue. They want to promote a more positive view of Japanese history. The Abe administration, and this is consistent with sort of the conservative outlook in Japan as a whole, is that Japan suffers not from too much nationalism, but too little. There's too little sense of pride and too little sense of patriotism. And they blame this sort of spiritual vacuum, as they see it, on the effects of the Second World War, on the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal, and on left-wing organizations such as the Asahi newspaper, such as many university professors, such as the Japan Teachers Association, for preventing the emergence of that kind of sense of nationhood. And this campaign has to be understood in that context. Now, this is not a mainstream. This is not the view of most Japanese. It is a view which resonates with many Japanese, but at the same time, I would say most Japanese are uncomfortable with this. And all is heightened by the new efforts that Japan is making on defense. Why this debate is breaking out at this particular moment is it's not an accident. It is breaking out because historically, since the Second World War, whenever Japan tries to engage taking a larger role in international security affairs, there is simultaneously a push, conservatives, to try to strengthen that sense of nationhood, to promote patriotism through history, through reforms in the education system, by adopting national symbols like the national anthem and so forth. And the Abe administration follows that. They see these two things as belonging together.
Well, just in closing then, Thomas Berger, is it possible that the U.S. could make a deal where in order to get Japan to be more assertive and cooperative in military affairs, that they could turn a blind eye to the resurgence of right-wing nationalism?
Well, there are some who would say that this is a purely domestic political affair. It is, of course, in the end, Japan is a sovereign nation, and it is, in the end, something that the Japanese themselves have to settle. But at the same time, it does concern us very much, and this is part of one of the problems that we right now are having is that Abe's stance on revisionism, assuming that it doesn't affect democracy, and if Japan really, if the democratic system in Japan begins to sort of become more fragile as a result of this campaign, then I think the entire legitimacy of the enterprise is going to change. But in addition to that, I mean, Abe's revisionism causes problems for the United States in at least two ways. First of all, it runs up against some really deeply held international norms, that is, issues such as the comfort women, such as the condemnation of Japanese wartime atrocities by the International Military Tribunal in the Far East, that is the sort of Japanese equivalent of the Nuremberg trials, is part of the foundation for the post-war international human rights regime. And questioning that max of Holocaust denial and that kind of revisionism really sort of shakes or is an attack on some of the normative cores of the international system that we have. But even if you put that aside, more practically, this causes lots of problems in East Asia. This kind of revisionism provoked very strong responses from Beijing and also not only from China, but also from the U.S. ally, South Korea, Republic of Korea, where there are very, very strong sentiments. And it raises tensions in the East Asian region. It makes issues such as the territorial dispute, the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands and the East China Seas, which I mentioned, more tense. It makes cooperation between U.S. allies in East Asia, most notably between Japan and South Korea, much more difficult, if not impossible. And that's a problem for the United States. We need our Asian allies to work together and help us deal with some very serious tensions, not only in China, but also in North Korea.
Well, Thomas Berger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, who is a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government in East Asia and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with Huri Berberian, who is just back from Turkey, where she demonstrated participated in a demonstration on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Huri Berberian, who is a professor of history and director of the Middle East Studies Program at California State University, Long Beach. She is the author of Armenians and the Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1905-1911, The Love for Freedom Has No Fatherland. And she has just returned from Istanbul, Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Huri Berberian.
Thank you.
And what kind of ceremonies were there in Turkey commemorating the Armenian Genocide, a very word that can't be used in Turkey? It looked as if there was a very cynical attempt on the part of the Turkish government to move forward the Gallipoli 100th anniversary in order to take this story off the headlines. And I suspect that the Turks did not succeed.
I think they did not. Not only on an international level, but also domestically. There were several commemorative events, the largest being on April 24th, when thousands of people gathered on Istiklal, right off of Taksim Square, where the Gezi Park protests took place not that long ago. And although there were actually quote-unquote counter-protesters, although ours was not a protest, they did not get far beyond the police barricades, but they were quite loud. But what I came out of this with was the incredible solidarity on the part of Turkish and Kurdish citizens of Turkey, not only to work with Armenians and others to recognize the genocide and bring forth justice, but also a general attempt to try to move forward on civil society changes within Turkey for equality and justice for all peoples of Turkey, including Armenians, but not exclusively.
And was your memorial demonstration, was it covered at all by Turkish media?
It was actually. It was certainly covered by the English Today Zaman, but also by Turkish newspapers. In fact, one of them had, for the first time in its history, its headline in the Armenian language. And so there was coverage by Turkish newspapers, and although my Turkish is very limited, I also noticed every evening, night when I went back to the hotel, that it was also on the news and on talk shows.
So do you think that it was a mistake then for the Australians and New Zealand government to send officials to Gallipoli? I noticed, for example, that the French president went to Yerevan along with Russian President Putin. And the French, of course, were just as involved with the Gallipoli landings as the British and the Dominion troops, as they were called in those days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was, actually. The strategy behind it was very clear. It was very cynical, as you yourself pointed out, to move the anniversary to the 24th, when Gallipoli had not even taken place until the day after, and for these governments to send their delegations there basically was a slap in the face for history, against history and truth and justice. But I suppose they felt that politically it was the right thing to do for them, but quite cynical.
And what's your sense, having just been in Turkey, of whether there's any chance in this upcoming elections that there could be a reversal away from the authoritarian rule of Erdogan, who is beginning to look more and more like a kind of menace on the world stage, at least to my mind?
Yes, and you know, in conversations with Turks, it was very obvious that Erdogan, even those who supported him in the beginning, were completely disappointed by him, and have been so as the economy has not been doing well, as Turkey is losing friends internationally. But whether that will actually have a huge impact on elections in June, it's very difficult to tell. There are many parties in the picture, and some of them, like the Kurdish parties, were very supportive of genocide recognition. But there are also as many, if not more powerful, conservative groups, political parties, that may not be like Erdogan, that may have a more nationalist agenda, which is also scary. So I'm not sure that the elections will make a tremendous difference. I hope they will, especially if some of these more progressive Kurdish parties come into parliament. That might gradually bring about change, but it won't be very quick. It won't be immediate anyway.
And again, I'm speaking with Houri Berberian, who's a professor of history and director of the Middle East Studies Program at California State University, Long Beach. She's the author of Armenians and the Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1905 to 1911, The Love of Freedom Has No Fatherland. And she has just returned from Istanbul, Turkey. So I guess the issue here with the forthcoming election in Turkey would be whether or not the bubble economy bursts. Apparently, it's an incredibly leveraged economy, particularly in the real estate sector. And we've seen examples of So it's after all called the Development Party, the ruling party, and they have certainly tried to tear up Gezi Park, a piece of greenery, one of the few pieces left in Istanbul, to build more high-rises. And of course, there's nothing more blatant example of what you could call an edifice complex than the palace that Erdogan built for himself. I think it's over $100 million worth of grandiosity.
Yes, and from my conversations again with Turks, it seems that they basically think that he is a thief who's profiting off of his position, and they don't expect anything from him. So I don't think that he will get many votes, or his party will get many votes in this coming election.
So, but he's a thief wrapped in piety, isn't he?
Yes. The worst kind, perhaps.
Right. So is there then still vestiges of secularism and a kind of secular backlash going on?
Oh, by all means, yes. And the secular backlash also has its negative aspects, and that is when it gets a bit too Kemalist or ultra-nationalist. So it's not necessarily that a secular alternative will necessarily be better, but one hopes.
And when you say you were just there for a week, is there any sense then that there's a movement, or is this just a resignation on the part of the people? Is there, you know, a counter-movement? Because it would seem to me pretty clear that Erdogan's popularity is it with the kind of rural parts of the country, and that the educated middle class and urban elites, etc., have already turned against him. So is this a case where the less educated, the more religious people, if you will, in the countryside are going to stick by him?
It's very possible. I don't have enough information or contact to be able to make that judgment. But definitely, at least in the urban centers, in particular segment of society, especially the educated intellectual class, there is actually a growing movement of civil society organizations and human rights activists who are struggling against the government today. And not only, obviously, on the Armenian Genocide Recognition Front, but also on the Kurdish front.
And on the crackdown on the freedom of the press and on the Gulenist movement, are those also a part of a backlash?
I believe so, yes.
So is there a sense then, having just been in Turkey at the time of the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, is there a sense that this was a terribly stupid missed opportunity on the part of the Turkish government, that they could have got out from under this thing with just a little bit of humility and less obdurance?
I think so. It's hard for me to be completely objective on the subject, obviously, being Armenian myself, but it was a missed opportunity. The 100th year anniversary would have been a very good time to not go backward on what he had said just a year ago, but to go forward. And there were some movements on the state's part to at least give the impression that they were going forward. For example, they sent a government official to the Patriarchate for the mass on April 24th for the victims of the Armenian Genocide. This was unprecedented. So there were some things they did to show that, you know, they're in sympathy, but sympathy doesn't necessarily mean recognition. And that, I don't think anybody thought was going to happen this year, but I suppose the hope is always there.
Well, though, given that the Pope made his statement, which created a really overheated reaction from both Erdogan and the Turkish Prime Minister, who accused Pope Francis of being part of an evil front. On top of that, Turkey's biggest trading partner in Europe, Germany, where there's an enormous Turkish diaspora, they came out and used the G word. Mm-hmm. So the question that hangs here is, why didn't Obama? He did it in his campaigns. Samantha Power went on record back in 2007, the U.S. UN representative. What's your understanding as American of Armenian descent, why Obama didn't use the G word?
Well, I assume that he thinks that it's not politically viable to do so, and I think his statements implied that on a personal level, perhaps he did not agree with the official U.S. position, which he was supporting, that, you know, it seemed to me that he thought, as he had said during his campaign, that he thought that there was genocide, but that he couldn't say it now in his position. It's disappointing. I suppose it's not surprising, but I think there was probably more hope that he would say a bit more or perhaps even use the word, given that there has been so much attention, as you pointed out, the Pope, the European Parliament as well, Germany, Austria coming forth using the word genocide. But you know, it's interestingly enough, the United States and Israel are the, you know, two of the countries that do not use the word genocide. And I understand, in a sense, the United States' position on it in terms of having military bases and so forth, needing Turkey's help on its many battlefronts in the Middle East. But I'm not so, I don't understand Israel's reluctance as nation, as a people who have themselves gone through genocide.
And also, Erdogan himself has basically tore up a very long-standing and quite harmonious relationship that Turkey had with Israel, with both in terms of tourism and human contacts, along with very deep military ties. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that Erdogan himself is an anti-Semite, so you wonder what the Israelis have got to lose by calling it like it is.
Yes, I suspect it has something to do with their relationship with the United States. There might be some you scratch my back, I scratch yours kind of thing going on.
Yeah. Well, the U.S. certainly does go to bat for Israel often at the U.N. So just in closing then, Huri Barbarian, you obviously were in Istanbul, you weren't in Yerevan, and that's where the French president and President Putin made his remarks, which angered Erdogan. Mm-hmm. But is there a sense, just going forward, that there will be, in other words, absent the 100th anniversary, which was an opportunity to clear the air a little bit, are people going to forget what's happened here because it's off the headlines, or is there going to be a continuing push for historical truth?
I think there will be a continuing push. I think the 100th anniversary and the fact that many of us could actually mark the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide in Istanbul has given us some impetus to move forward in collaboration with Turkish and Kurdish civil rights, human rights organizations and civil society organizations. And that collaboration and that solidarity, I think, is the way forward.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Huri Barbarian.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Huri Barbarian, who is a professor of history and director of the Middle East Studies Program at California State University, Long Beach. She's the author of Armenians and the Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1905 to 1911, The Love of Freedom Has No Fatherland. And she has just returned from Istanbul, Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.